Continuing with our study of the canopy over the earth in the original creation, the canopy in the Reformation, until it was broken up in the flood. We are proved it was broken up then and not before then. As there will be a canopy in the millennium. I don't have any doubt of this at all. I don't believe it's just a theory. I don't believe it's just a wild dream or a wild idea. I believe it is scriptural, and I think you will too before we get through. I taught this about 45 years ago, long before the Bible Science Research Society started teaching it, and before Dallas Theological Seminary started teaching it. Early in the writings of Dallas Theological Seminary, as in the Bibliotheca Sacra, I never found it at all. And the strange part about it was, Dallas used to teach the gap theory way back then, not the young earth theory. But there is no way to understand the Edenic condition that existed on earth before the flood. You could not have the same envelope. I'm using this word envelope because a lot of the early geologists used to use it. I'll quote from some of them. The earth had an envelope enclosing it that certainly was the factor in, and by the way, we shall see, many of these ancient geologists believed in this also, that the condition of the earth was completely different at one time. You'll see they had a dozen different ways of explaining it, since they wouldn't take the Bible. Parish forbid that they should take anything out of the Bible for proof. Yet the Bible science is way ahead of theirs. You can't explain possibly the condition upon the earth recorded in Genesis 1 through 6. The first chapter through the sixth chapter. Until the flood, without realizing that something had to be different in order to give this Edenic condition pole to pole. And geology, we shall see, also admits it, but then explains it wrongly. We just barely started in our last lesson. Without some kind of a canopy, the earth is not a perfectly ideal environment for man's habitation. Man has a constant struggle to live upon the earth since the fall, with its extremes of variation of temperature, very uncomfortable and only a little more impossible. His various seasons, from very hot in places to very cold. He is subject to premature aging. I'm getting more conscious of that all the time. Disease wearing out of his body from birth to death. The body is continually fighting the forces of decay, corruption, disease invasion, and death. Every cell in him dies every week. Some say 30 days. Now most scientists say every week. It must be replaced. Besides man's difficulty in providing enough food to live, fighting every hazard of drought and heat and freeze and blight and insects and infertility and spoilage, and even when he gets a good crop, all of a sudden, blasting and mildew and fungus takes the crop away. I remember helping my father farm 20 acres in South Alpala Gardens, south of Miami. We had a beautiful 20 acres. I mean beautiful. Then all of a sudden, blight hit the thing, and it was just like you'd had a great freeze. Everything wilted to the ground, except one crop. And that was the Kentucky Wonder pole bean. And we made a good good. We made almost $5,000 on the Kentucky Wonder, about an acre of Kentucky Wonder beans. And he turned it all over to a dear friend in the church, and he stole it all. You can't win some days for losing. Man finds his environment very hostile, an enemy. We shall see God said this in Romans 8. Yet in Eden it wasn't so. Man did not need any clothes against heat or cold. He didn't need to earn his living by the sweat of his brow. He didn't have to wrest a bare subsistence from starvation upon from the earth. So in prophecy, that's looking back to Genesis. So prophetically, you're looking forward to the millennium and to eternity. There are promises it won't be so in the millennium. The reaper shall catch up with the sower. Only now, after Adam's fall and the curse has been placed upon the ground, cursed is the ground for thy sake. And Genesis 3:17, and the creation was made subject to vanity, emptiness, as in Romans 8:19-21. This word vanity is emptiness, non-attainment for which it was made. But we read, the creation itself shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption, which is decay, into the glorious liberty of the sons of God. It is when the manifestation of the sons of God at the close of the tribulation period, just before the millennium, at Christ's revelation. Romans shows that this groaning state of non-fulfillment is not as it was when it came in the hand of God. It was made subject to vanity when man sinned and when man fell. Before that, it didn't have that groaning, travailing in pain together until now, awaiting the redemption, the adoption, to it the redemption of our bodies. Man is face to face with a very hostile world, unfriendly, in climate, in provision, in accident, in disease, in suffering, in death, with his life held in precarious balance between heat and cold, sickness and health, feast and famine, accident and prosperity, life and death, instead of longevity, man's life is swifter than a weaver's shuttle. It's like the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow's cast into the oven. It wasn't so before the flood. Man lived to be the life of a tree. Almost 1,000 years. Methuselah, 969 years. Now, Moses, in the 90th Psalm, in the 10th verse, places man's lifespan as 70. That's 70 years. And he says, if it can be increased 10 years, it's only suffering and sorrow. Because after you get 70, you begin to become a part of the scene. You begin to have more aches and pains, more debilitating things, and more restrictions upon your spirit's desire to do more things. He said, if it be increased to 80, it is your strength and labor is only sorrow. This indicates its very brevity is a blessing. I'm glad I don't have to live to be 1,000 years of age with the body I've got now. All nature bears witness to a change, a cataclysmic change, for worse. From a high estate to a low one. From a perfect to a groaning creation. At the flood. Not before. The scripture paints a picture of a garden or a paradise of God. The word Eden means paradise. Now he planted a special garden for the test. But the whole earth, from pole to pole, was under the canopy. And therefore, we shall draw the picture given here by geologists of what must have been All nature bears abundant testimony that this present groaning creation is not the best that God could make for his creatures, made in his image. Nor is it the best that he has provided. Nor is it the best that he yet shall provide in the millennium and in eternity. Because it has been made subject to vanity, groaning in pain. When it came from the creative fingers of God, it was perfect in all its time. So also prophecy tells us that in the restitution of all things, it shall be that way again, when the desert shall blossom as a rose. But now, instead of man being nature's lord, man is nature's slave, subject to all its fluctuations, diseases, accidents, vanities, unfulfillment. Now, what we wish to discern is what makes the difference from before the flood and now. And now and in the millennium. Between the very good of God's verdict over all of his creation in Genesis 3. There is a vast physical difference in the earth itself from before the flood and after the flood, making great portions of the earth unfit for human habitation. All of it uncomfortable most of the time for human life. Five of our planets, of the nine in our solar system, already have some kind of a canopy. As the earth, we shall see, has several canopies over it. The space probe of Venus shows almost the same type of destruction as upon the earth in the original creation, when it was without form and void. They have put radio communication, the one satellite that landed on Venus, but it couldn't tell what they need to know. It doesn't seem to have the hard crust that the moon and the earth has. Maybe they'll find out someday, I don't know. But with 930 degrees Fahrenheit heat all around Venus, and the sun's rays can't even shine through the cloud into Venus. It is unfit for any kind of life as we know it. The Earth itself has, and by the way, Saturn, of course, the rings of Saturn is one of the most famous of the canopies. We found a lot more about that, those rings now, in the probe of Saturn. Right now, the Earth has several canopies in various gases stretching out for a distance of 1,500 miles. In the troposphere, the stratosphere, and the ionosphere. The troposphere is the oxygen layer around the Earth, up to about 7 or 8 miles. Of course, you can't live out that far, some 40,000 feet out. Where the temperature for those 7 or 8 miles decreases rapidly. They don't know why, but the stratosphere seems to have one temperature all the way through it. And then when you leave the stratosphere and get into the ionosphere, it begins, of course, drop rapidly into absolute zero, about 460 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. The ionosphere is made up mostly of ionized, that's why they call it ionosphere, ionized molecules. It is this envelope of ionized molecules that makes radio communication, shortwave radio communication, possible around the Earth. All your radio waves of that range bounce off the ionosphere back to Earth. They go out some 1,500 miles and bounce back. And what causes the loss of your signal sometimes on radio during great is the great sunstorms, sunspots, tear up the ionosphere. And the signal, instead of bouncing back, goes on through. Somewhat like the radio waves and television waves that come from the moon when they're sending back from there. And then, of course, the radio waves from Venus and Mars and from Saturn. And they're still getting signals back from the one that went on past. Well, this last one that went on past and is out there in space caught a little ways. Besides this, there are several other envelopes or canopies the Earth has. There's a magnetic field. The magnetic field goes through the Earth and, of course, radiates from the polarity in the Earth causing the magnetic field. It goes on out into space quite a ways. Some 1,000 miles into space this magnetic field goes out. You won't say a whole lot about it. In the stratosphere, some 7 or 8 miles, starting 7 or 8 miles out, but probably a little further out than that, there is an envelope of ozone. This is the one that's been worrying the environmentalists, worrying the government. It's why they stopped the companies from putting Freon in all of their aerosol dispensers. These were contaminating the ozone. The ozone, unlike oxygen, is made up of 3 atoms instead of 2. And it's lighter. And it's out there probably, I think, 15 miles or so, if I remember rightly. And it enshrouds the whole Earth with this canopy of ozone. It is very valuable, and they've been worried that it'll be destroyed. All the rockets go through it. The shuttle goes through it. I'm wondering if we can continue to use it because it tears up that layer and allows much of the ozone to escape. All the air conditioners use Freon. And when they're destroyed, the ozone is let loose and it ascends to that same height as the ozone layer and begins to destroy it. Contaminated. Many other inventions are ruining it. Besides that ozone, there is a Van Allen belt of radioactive particles that surrounds the Earth. It's a belt of very high radioactive particles forming a canopy around the Earth some 600 to 700 miles out. This Van Allen belt was discovered by Van Allen, named after him. We'll say a little bit more about this in Christian apologetics to show the God had to create this to put all these right in the right place so that life was possible on the Earth. But it is just exactly the right thickness, the Van Allen belt. If it were a little thicker, almost everybody would have rickets and die of rickets. If it were a little thinner, we would die of radiation. It's just exactly right. Now, in apologetics, I'll give you the wavelength of it and a little bit more about it. But the Bible teaches it used to have another one. And it's yet going to have another one. An ice crystal canopy It'd have to be ice crystals. If it's vapor, it's water. We'll show you that in Genesis. No doubt at a high altitude. I still believe that the younger theorists are wrong about the distance out it was. I believe it was just at the edge of the ionosphere, or maybe even above the ionosphere. I have a lot of reasons in my own mind. I'm not a scientist, but I have a lot of reasons in my own mind for believing it. I believe it would be necessary to be that far out to give the hothouse atmosphere for this Earth, and even to diffuse the light brightly around the Earth. I believe if it were lower, it would not do it. That canopy was held out there by two forces, centripetal and centrifugal. The gravitation would hold the thing in static state, like the static satellites out in space. Remember, they don't circle the Earth. They stay right out there in one point, because they put them out just at the right speed so that they would stay there. They're held by, as the Earth turns, they're turning with the Earth, and the gravitational pull, the centripetal force, holds it from going out into space, and then its speed, as it turns with the Earth at 1,000 miles an hour, keeps it from falling into the Earth. This is what would hold this canopy of ice crystals out there. Now let's look at some biblical proofs. In Genesis 1, 6, and 7, many have not understood this text because they didn't understand the canopy. God said, "Let there be a firmament." All the evolutionists say, and all the Bible detractors say, firmament here is the old idea of a solid heaven of crystal. Not the idea at all. How could the birds fly in the midst of the firmament if it were a crystal? In the same text. The same Hebrew word is translated expanse in verse 20. The fowl that may fly in the open firmament. And I have the text here somewhere where it's fast, but I don't see it right now. And God said, "Let there be a firmament," or a clear expanse, "and let it be a means of dividing," I'm reading Rotherham, "between the waters and the waters." And God made the expanse, and it divided between the waters that were under the expanse and the waters that were above the expanse. That is all the clear air. I believe it is above all the air. The atmosphere. Right at the very edge. Now, it has to be ice crystals. For several reasons. It would be too cold up there to be water. Any moisture would freeze at that altitude, not that. It couldn't stay up there. It's just plain H2O. If it were too thick, it wouldn't do the job. I believe that they were very small ice crystals. You could see some of these ice crystals on any summer evening or night when the moon comes out and there's a lot of moisture in the air, and you see the halo around the moon. That's formed by ice crystals. Not just water. Ice crystals. And God called the expanse heavens, and fowl that fly in the open firmament of heaven. This is the clear crystal canopy above the stratosphere, probably on into the ionosphere. At just the right height and thickness to give the hothouse effect universally upon the earth, and also light around the earth, we shall see. So that there was no real night or day. It was only a softer light at night, as it will be in the millennium. You'll see in Zechariah 14. This canopy was not broken up until the flood. Now let's look at a number of other texts in Genesis and other places that proves it. First, there was no rain until the flood. But there were no clouds. There's no variation in temperature. Genesis 2, 5 through 6. And these are the generations of the heavens and of the earth. This word generations occurs 10 times in the book of Genesis and divides Genesis into 10 different divisions. They're called the book of the generation in 5:1, when they were created on the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. And every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb in its generation, now notice, for the Lord God made the earth, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was not a man to till the ground, but there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground, all around the earth. Many call this dew. It wasn't dew. The Hebrew word, Jacinius, the Hebrew scholar, says, a vapor rising from the earth and forming clouds. He said, because it surrounded the earth like a veil. The Hebrew word in the Septuagint, translated in the Septuagint in the Greek, pege, P-E-G-E, is translated fountain. Since it was to water the whole earth, it wasn't a little local dew, even a local mist. God had some physical thing that caused the water to evaporate, not by the sun. The sun would not evaporate the water. The change of temperature would not do it. All these things are necessary for rain now. We will say something more about the rain and the apologetics. God used some kind of a vapor, a very thick vapor, coming up out of the ground, probably either late in the evening or at night, and watering the whole earth. Now, you'll see a little later, this was copious. It was more than adequate. For all geology recognized that this earth used to have verdure covering it. And it had to cover it to a great depth. This earth was a paradise of verdure. The oil and coal deposits show it. You'd almost have to have 1,000 feet of forest verdure pressed down in order to get only a foot of coal. And then was put under great pressure and great heat in order to make the carbonaceous material into coal or into oil. Both of them were once living upon the surface of the earth. Yet some of them are 5 or 6 miles under the earth now. Something has happened. You'll see more of that. So first there's no rain. Now that made a vast difference in the geology of the face of the earth. And the canopy is the only thing that would explain it. Second, hence there's no rainbow. When God overthrew the earth with a flood, he broke up the canopy, and from now on out there's a rainbow. The sun shining not through a canopy, but through the raindrops. Makes the rainbow. Third, there was no wind. No thermal drafts. The thermal draft causes most of the rain. You see them explaining that once in a while on TV, one of the better weather prophets from the American Meteorological Society. All of you that have been in an airplane have seen gone around a thunderhead that's reaching up to maybe 30 or 40 or 50,000 feet. And you can imagine that thermal draft, as hot as it is, laden with from a low-pressure area, laden with moisture, going up that high into 40 and 50 and 60 degrees below zero, the condensation will take place. Most of it, of course, turns to ice, and then it has a chance to turn to water before it gets to earth. Many of them say you could find a lot of hailstones up there that are not hailstones at the time they reach earth, if the condition is not right. But there could not have been any seasons, or there could be no wind, no thermal drafts, no storms, no hurricanes, no conflicting fronts of weather, no high and low pressure. And it all is in this next text, under number 4. No seasons, no wind. Genesis 8:1 and 8:22. God made a wind to pass over the earth after the flood. And verse 22, something new. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. I'll show you in another text. There was no day or night. Vice versa, since everyone is. But there'll be no seed time and harvest. There wasn't any before the flood. But there were no seasons. But suddenly there are seasons. In chapter 8, verse 22. Here's another one, number 5. There were no carnivorous beasts upon the earth. From Adam, the flood. Here's why I can't believe in the young earth. We'll be dealing with that a little later in another aspect, but primarily in prophecy class. As we see, the prophecy is that in the millennium there will be no meat eating. None at all. The lions will eat straw like the ox. And they shall both lie down together, and the child shall play on the cockatrice den, and a little child shall eat a lion, and nothing shall hurt me before it all my holy mountains. No carnivorous beasts, man or animal, till after the flood. And the reason for this are the actinic rays, which are primarily held back by the Van Allen Belt. The actinic rays of the sun destroy amino acids. They destroy protein. They cause premature aging. Here's why man lived so long before the flood and immediately was cut down after the flood to 120 years, and then and even some people lived to be 139, but cut down to 110. You notice as you read the genealogies in Genesis, a sudden nosedive of longevity. And God said, Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth. I underscore that word all. I don't believe there are any sand spurs. I don't believe there are any poison herbs. I don't believe there is any poison oak or poison ivy before the flood. And every tree in which is the fruit of the tree yielding fruit, to you it shall be for meat, for food, as it will be in the morning. Man needs meat. In fact, they'll tell you that if you're strictly vegetarian and won't even eat any product of an animal at all, no milk, no eggs, no cheese, no yogurt, you're going to have a very great problem trying to get enough protein. For amino acids only come from protein, and amino acids are necessary to build tissue. Here's why Paul calls him a weak brother if he's herbivorous. There in the 14th chapter of Romans. He's weak not only spiritually, he's weak physically. If you don't believe that you're supposed to eat meat, notice that God said Noah wouldn't eat. He took clean beasts into the ark so he'd have something not only to sacrifice, but to eat. You read God's commandment in the 9th chapter of Genesis. God gave them command to eat meat. But longevity is caused by was caused by the holding back of the pink rays of the sun. Before the flood and in the millennium, man's life should be as the life of a tree, Isaiah 63:20. All the new evangelicals who deny the literalness of the first 10 chapters of Genesis, all the modernists and liberals who try to explain the first 10 chapters of Genesis, explain, say that those were lunar years, not solar years. It takes 12 and a half lunar years to make a solar year. Maybe once a month, a little over. There's no record of a change, but a tapering off. But here's the peculiar thing. Enoch was 65 years of age when his son was born, so he was exactly 5 and a half years of age when he started his family. I know they might have been precocious in those days, but I don't believe it. Arphaxad was 2 and a half years of age when his child was born. How foolish. These were not lunar years, they were solar years, as God appointed them in Genesis 1. But not only that, number 7, the actinic rays of the sun causes most of the fermentation to rotten. Not only ages living flesh, it rots dead flesh and it rots dead vegetation. You can see this in Noah making wine. He'd done that before for all the years of his life till the flood, and never got drunk. When he came out of the ark, when the grapes started growing, he made some wine and forthwith got drunk. You notice God didn't blame him. He blamed the kid for laughing at him. Ham. He didn't blame Noah. For his wine never fermented before that. And I don't believe it because he drank it so fast. But geology, number 8, geology confirms, that is the honest geologist, confirms the fact that this earth at one time had an ideal climate from pole to pole. All geology recognizes this fact. It rejects the Bible's explanation. Somewhere here I've got a list of some of the crazy reasons they get for it. One of the primary ones is either the continental drift or a collision like Bilikowski gives in his Earth and Upheaval. A planetary invasion or a splashing of the Earth, not just a meteorite, it wouldn't be large enough. Some big meteorites would hit this Earth. That one in Russia was, I think, over a half mile across. And it knocked down every tree for over a couple hundred miles. Reader's Digest had an article in there on that great collision of that meteorite. It fell in Siberia. It's a great crater in the Earth. And every tree, you could even see them still remaining there probably about 500 or 600 years ago. They don't know exactly when it was. There is a Chinese legend about it, but it would have shaken the whole Earth. But Bilikowski believes that either Saturn or one of the planets came so close to the Earth and hit it a glancing blow and knocked it off its axis. And the North Pole then was at the equator. Therefore, you'd have at the North Pole and South Pole, then you could get all that vegetation that's there now under the ice. But I don't know of any real geologist who believes this. Maybe I'll find this place in here where I gave a few of their wild theories. They're interesting. See what they'll believe when they won't believe the scriptures. but the most common one is a meteorite or a planet collision. Oh, I found another place here. Sun interference, shifting the Earth on its axis, rising and falling of the seacoast, shifting of the Gulf Stream, drifting of the continents, hot Earth cooling, increase of carbonic acid, heating of the sun, change in the Earth's orbit around the sun, etc., etc. But that the Earth once enjoyed an Eddenic climate over all of its surface, geology abundantly testifies. When, why, and how? Professor J.D. Dana, D-A-N-A, a leading American geologist of the last century, and I believe he's a believer. I love to quote him in Christian Apologetics and many other places. In his book, Manual of Geology, page 136, says, "Nothing at the present day can convey to us the idea of the prodigious and immense extent of the never-changing verdure which clothed the earth from pole to pole." In the quotation. Then on page 150, quotation marks. "This terrestrial period is characterized in a remarkable manner by the abundance and strangeness of the vegetation which then covered the islands and the continents of the whole globe upon all points of this earth. This flora presented a striking uniformity." End the quotation. Lewis Figure, in his book, The World Before the Deluge, a member of the Royal Society of Geologists of Great Britain in the last century, on page 133 wrote, "What we now call climate was unknown in these geological times. There seems to have been only one climate over the whole globe." And further states, "It is a remarkable circumstance that conditions of equable warm climate combined with humidity do not seem to have been limited to any one part of the globe, but the temperature of the whole globe seems to have been nearly the same in every different latitude." Get that. In every different latitude, from the equatorial region to the Arctic Ocean, where in our day eternal frost prevails, from Spitsbergen to the center of Africa. The carboniferous flora is identically the same as in the fossils. I'll show you that from other articles. "When nearly the same plants are found in Greenland or Guinea, when the same species are met with equal development at the equator as at the pole, we cannot but admit that at this epoch, the temperature of the globe was nearly alike everywhere." And here's what he confesses. "What we call climate was unknown in the geological time." And then on page 417, "It is probable that from pole to pole, from the equator to the extremity to the axis, the earth must have formed a vast and boundless plateau, and such an abundant past age was absolutely necessary to sustain such prodigious numbers of herbivorous animals of such great size." Admiral Byrd wrote in the National Geographic magazine, "The climate of the Antarctica must have been once temperate or subtropical." George McCready Price, a Seventh-day Adventist, and I believe a very, very good geologist. He was professor of geology at Union College in Nebraska. In his book, The New Geology, page 652, writes, There is but one planet known to the ancient fossil world as revealed by the plants and animals entombed in the rocks. And that planet was a mantle of spring-like loveliness. That's from pole to pole, remember? And a shifting of the axis doesn't explain this at all. Spring-like loveliness, which seemed to have prevailed continuously over the whole of the globe. Just how the world could have been thus warmed all over may be a matter of conjecture. That it was so warmed effectively and continuously is a matter of fact. Then he adds some more facts, page 657. The great general fact is that we have a whole fossil world. Think that. That's a fact. A whole fossil world on our hands, buried by moving water. And this is the one prime and essential fact which we have to deal in interpreting the long past history of our globe. In the quotation mark from George McCreedy Price. Again, Dr. Lewis Figuel, page 435. I want you to get these. Right? Just listen to them. Geology admits this earth had one climate, one virgin, from pole to pole. It's the explanation of it they have problems with. Since George McCreedy Price didn't believe in a canopy, evidently. He might before he died. I don't know. I think he said that. Of course, the modernists don't like George McCreedy Price. I don't like his Seventh-day Adventism, but his theology is wonderful. Not just because it agrees with him. Page 435, quotation marks. The northern and central parts of Europe, the vast countries which extend from the Scandinavia to the Mediterranean and the Danube, were visited by a period of sudden and severe cold. Now, I agree with the new Earth theorists. I believe the last ice age took place at the flood. The last ice age. Now, it is interesting that most geologists of repute put it about 10,000 years ago. It certainly puts it within the sphere of action. I believe there was an ice age that followed the first destruction. It would have if the canopy were destroyed before this thing became so gaseous and heat penetrated the whole mess. Notice what he says. This whole period of Europe was visited by a period of sudden and severe cold. The temperature of the polar region seized them. The plains of Europe were ornamented by the luxurious vegetation developed by the heat of a burning climate. The boundless pastures on which lay herds of great elephants. The active horse, the robust hippopotamus. You'll see a little later in the frozen islands in the Barren Sea are formed by great frozen fossilized animals, the mastodon and the marmot, the saber-toothed tiger, hippopotamus that far north. I'm going to have something more to say about those. The robust hippopotamus, the great carnivorous animals, grazed and became covered with a mantle of ice and snow. To what cause are we to attribute a phenomenon so unforeseen, exercising itself with such intensity? In the present state of our knowledge, no certain explanation of the event can be given. And then he gives the planetary invasion theory. George Cuvier, another Frenchman, C-U-V-I-E-R, if I can learn to pronounce his, I can learn to pronounce Cuvier. He was a great geologist. In his book, Fossil Bones, writes, the fossils tell us with certainty that the globe has not always had the same envelope. A prominent evolutionist, Dr. Ray Ethan Torres, in his book on botany, an evolutionist, page 61 wrote, "We know that in the Cretaceous period, eternal summer reigned over the whole earth." I could quote again and again and again. A lot more of them. But from the North Pole to the South Pole, this earth gives evidence of a spring-like loveliness reigning supreme. No winter and summer, no season, no rain. A paradise. Universally. Within even a few degrees of the North Pole, we shall see, and the South Pole, a rich forest reigned. And tropical animals. Pines, sequoias, or redwoods. Other tropical trees are encased in ice at the South Pole. There was a long article in, and certainly this is not a hotbed of fundamentalism, in the National Geographic magazine. I cut the article out. In October of 1969, it was during the geophysical year, the International Geophysical Year, of 69. The magazine, the National Geographic, had a complete article by Rear Admiral George J. Dufek, who headed up the American team that built that permanent base in Antarctica, that's at the South Pole. And on page 540, very interesting reading from a magazine like that. It was their explanation that I didn't care much for. They found with coal within 200 miles of the South Pole. Coal deposits. Coal deposits can only be made by great forests. Suddenly overthrown and buried and pressed with great heat. They've learned how to make coal. They can make coal and oil by a process, but they have to use great heat. And they have to use great pressure to suddenly transform the vegetation, dead vegetation, into coal and oil. But within 200 miles of the South Pole, coal deposits. And within 300 miles, petrified wood. Fossilized leaves of tropical vegetation. Coral that can only grow in real tropical water. Coral has to have a certain temperature. That's why you don't find any coal being formed in Antarctica or in Arctic surface. It just isn't. But it was at one time. Palms. Huge ferns. Araucaria, a tall, majestic evergreen that grows only in Brazil and Chile and in the South Sea Islands, near the equator. All bearing witness to a tropical verdant coverage sometime in the past. The very same story is true of the North Pole. Unlike the South Pole, though, the North Pole is over water. There's no land mass under the North Pole. Here's why the Nautilus, the atomic submarine, went underneath it and navigated all across the North Pole into the European waters without coming up. I think it's the second trip they made. This was in the National Geographic. He had a wonderful article circumnavigating the globe underneath the water. One time they came up and broke through the ice. They could tell where it was thinner by the looking up through it. They could see the lightness, and of course they were taking a chance, but the conning tower could break through the ice And it's an interesting story. But the South Pole is a land mass. But the vast coal deposits of the Earth are not where you would expect them to be, in the temperate and tropical zones. In fact, the greatest coal and oil deposits are further north. Russia is setting upon, in Siberia, a coal and an oil deposit the size of this world. Makes the Arabian and the American coal and oil deposits insignificant. The only trouble is they haven't got the technology to use it, so we're going to do it for them. Khrushchev was right. We'll bury you, but you'll form the shovel for us. You'll furnish the shovel. We are. We'll start from there in our next lesson. You're dismissed.